In the 123rd Block Talks, we speak with Sean Delaney, head of BD at Sense, who tells us about the role of content creation in Web3 sales. I'm your host, Mauricio Magaldi, and this is Block Drops, your weekly digest on blockchain for business.
These news are not a form of endorsement, sponsorship, or encouragement for consumption, and are meant for educational purposes only.
All right, everybody, I'm here with Sean Delaney, who's going to tell us who he is and what he does with blockchain. Sean, it's such a pleasure to have you on the show. Welcome to Block Talks.
Thanks very much, mate. It's a pleasure to be here, and thanks for asking. So, my name is Sean. I'm from London, but currently residing in Vietnam, where I've been for the last couple of years. And, it's been since I've been in Vietnam that I've been kind of working within the blockchain Web3 space. Prior to that, I've had one stint in Vietnam. So it's a place I know well. For anyone else that knows the area, it's got a buzzing Web3 community. And that's one of the key reasons I've stuck around. So, I guess my first dabble with anything blockchain related was back when I was in London, 2017. And I was working for a cloud computing data center company. And around about the time of the bull market at that point, suddenly got this influx of inquiries for people looking to host their miners in our data centers. So that combined with sort of Bitcoin reaching its then all-time high kind of piqued my interest. I very much jumped on the bandwagon, bought a very small amount of Bitcoin and I think Litecoin back in the day, and then I completely forgot about it. Which was quite nice because that very little amount turned into something quite nice a few years later. But it certainly wasn't the kind of aha moment for blockchain or Web3 by any stretch of the means. That happened in, 2022. So funnily enough, a pretty dark time for the industry as a whole. But I moved out to Vietnam through a contact, a good friend of mine that asked me to come and manage the kind of sales and marketing department for a Web3 development company based in Saigon. So I gladly accepted that because Vietnam's a kind of place dear to my heart. This was kind of my first introduction to what blockchain can do outside of the crypto space. And I started taking a keen interest in what our developers were working on, which was a real range of projects because they weren't our products, they were our clients. So, I started speaking to founders and developers who were involved with, a range of projects from, the travel sector to supply chain, ticketing. And that, I think, was the minute that kind of the penny dropped for me. And I was like, okay, there is a lot more to this stuff than kind of speculative trading and whatnot. That was the kind of first time that I really kind of developed a passion. And a big thing for me at that point as well, I was like, okay, well, the general population either know nothing or had the very limited view that I did. So I started, I was already sort of creating content. At that time, I was a sort of fair weather content creator. I do it a bit more now. But I started to create content really initially for my own learning. I was like, okay, I want to go out and find out more about NFTs. They're not just digital art, pictures of apes, right? Actually looking at NFTs and, as ticketing or potentially looking at soulbound tokens for digital identity. And I started creating content around that, and it kind of picked up a bit of traction and, flywheel effect. It helped my business. I was getting more leads, but I was having more interesting conversations with people that were building within the space. And it kind of took off from there. I would say sort of since then, part of my passion is creating content around stuff in Web3 for either the layman or somebody that was in my situation that didn't really know too much outside of what makes the noise in the crypto space. And that's kind of really what kind of started my journey in it. I spent a long part of my time in Vietnam talking to founders of businesses, building really cool things in the space. And I found myself quite lucky in that sense.
Yeah, I like that you started very, I want to say unsophisticated, but your recent stuff is like fire, man. I mean, what led you to develop such a unique, I'd say, language when bringing that content to life? Because it's obviously something that, you know, I've been doing this for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. I hate video with a passion, and you make it look easy because not only the content you put out is very well produced, it is meaningful because it's knowledgeable. You're not talking, you know, through your elbows. You're just talking, you know, the challenges and the benefits. Like, there's a very business-like angle to what you do, but they're also visually appealing. And that is not necessarily something that, I mean, I imagine with the, you know, the newer tools, it's easier for you to come to that level of production, but you've been doing this for quite some time. Can you walk us through, you know, how was the learning process for that? And the audience knows this is just for my own selfish curiosity.
No worries. Cool. Thanks. That means a lot to the kind words you're saying. It's something I've worked on a lot over the past sort of year and a half. But I'd say that the biggest reason I've kind of got quite good at it, and I'd say efficient with the content and the video creation, is really just because it was something I was passionate about. If you told me to go and create 100 videos on, you know, the latest accounting system, the videos would be poor because I don't have that same passion, you know. So, you know, everything, even down to sort of the editing and the software that I've been playing around with, I've only got okay at using that and quite good at it because the content that I'm talking about is something that interests me. And that's what I always advise anyone, you know, out there that is creating content, is it's got to be kind of authentic. And then again, if you'd have told me I'd like doing video a few years ago, I would have laughed at you and said, no way, you know, absolutely no way. But again, I've just, you know, I did it enough times that I kind of, the camera almost seems invisible now. And then all I'm doing is I'm talking like I'm talking to you about something I'm interested in. You know, so it takes a while to sort of remove that self-conscious thing about the camera being there. But once you've got to that point, you know, if it's generally something you're interested in, which I am, in the topics that I talk about, then it becomes a little bit more easy. And as I said, you know, for my role at Sense, most of my days were taken up talking to people who were founders of businesses building cool things, you know, and I would learn on every call, every meeting, I was learning something new, a new application. So then I'd be like, okay, I'm going to go and create about this, you know, and I'll, you know, name drop them, go, you know, there's the sort of no ulterior motive other than a lot of the content for me was going, okay, what is this concept? Here's an example of somebody doing that, because that's how it kind of connected the dots for me. And then all I'm doing on this video, you know, a lot of my videos probably look like I've got some sort of, you know, promotion with this company or I'm endorsing them, but it's not. It's just something that I really, it made sense what they're doing. And all I'm doing is going to talk about it and kind of regurgitating, it, you know, what they taught me effectively. So it's an enjoyable way of doing it. I think that's a big thing with the space is, I mean, it's common. Any new technology, at the beginning, all the information out there is tech-led, right? So you then have this bit where you're going, well, how do we bring on non-technical people, commercial or users or whatever like that? And it's just finding a way to communicate the value rather than the tech. It's almost a bit of a translation piece, and that's the bit I've kind of enjoyed because it was just a learning thing for me at the beginning.
In terms of production value, right? I think the process of learning, understanding, translating that into more like human terms and less jargon is very familiar, at least to me and the audience. But what the value I feel you're adding is not only making things more palatable, but also they're enjoyable. I mean, it's fun to watch the videos, and you come across as very natural, but there's a lot of like visual effects that you add to it to make it more dynamic. And that kind of, you know, just grabs the attention. It's visually appealing. And you were not as sophisticated when you started. How did you go from recording Sean in, you know, a park somewhere to just giving those short, you know, lessons that not only communicate the content and the knowledge, but also grabs the attention of the viewer for, you know, it's, they're not long videos, but even, you know, in the world of short span of attention that we have today, they are very, you know, grabby. They're sticky. I, you know, it's not because I'm a, you know, we're friends, you know, but every time there's a video of you, I just stop to watch because I want to know what's the new effects, you know, what is the new use case. But more importantly, like, this is like, just to, you know, genuinely appreciate that there's high production value in what you do. Is this something that you, how did you learn that? And how are you making that not a central point to what you do, but using that a compliment and actually, you know, get people's attention to then, you know, oh, they're talking, Sean's talking about that use case. Amazing. Like, there is a contributing effect to what you do visually, to what you're adding in terms of knowledge to the community. How did you come to that?
I'd say initially, it was, I kind of got given the push to do it through people that were kind of already doing this. You know, I made friends with people that created good video content, and we've got a mutual friend, Dennis, who was instrumental in helping me in these early days. And, you know, I think an inhibitor that I had initially with video, I mean, there was loads, to be honest, all self-imposed. But this kind of idea that you got to have the best camera setup, the best studio, when reality, that was just kind of me procrastinating to not start. And, you know, one thing Dennis told me was just, you know, don't spend any money. Don't go out there. Don't pay for any software. Use the phone you've got in your pocket. Start recording videos. He gave me some really useful tips on kind of how to record, how to edit and whatnot. The process of then getting better at it was just a case of kind of going again with the viewpoint, right? Just say it takes 100 times of doing something to get good at it. Right, it'd take me 100 videos to get good at creating video. It's up to me. Do I stretch that 100 over 2 years, or do I do 100 in 2 months? Because I'll get to the same level of quality output, whether it takes 2 years or 2 months. So I kind of, in the early stages, just went, okay, look, I'm going to suck at the beginning, but that's fine because it's a new skill. It's like learning a new instrument. You know, aside from that, finding people that were kind of a similar place in their content creation journey, particularly with video, having some accountability in groups and stuff. But it was, I think the kind of two biggest things is people will either, they don't start because they'll sort of create this barrier to starting. I've got to have this equipment. I've got to have this set up, which is absolutely not the case. Or they will start and they will perfect over the first video. It will end up taking them, you know, hours and hours and hours, and then you go, well, I haven't got time to do that. I can't do that in my day job. Where, you know, the reality for me, it was start, don't spend too long on it, just get it out there. No one's going to see your first 30 videos anyway. As you know the nature of toying with algorithms, you know, it, in some senses it works quite well because no one's going to watch your videos when they're not very good. They'll start to pick up traction, you know, further down the line. But yeah, going back to what I said before, you know, the key thing is talk about something you're interested in, you know, the same way as you with your podcasts that have been so fantastic, your passion for blockchain and the space comes off. If someone told you to do a podcast on something you have no interest in, you know, it would be a lot more hard work getting them done and edited and finding guests, you know, same thing with video, you know, like, anyone can get good at this stuff. Anyone can get good at creating content. I think it's just about starting and then staying started.
Your comment kind of highlights two important things for me in the whole of Web3. One is the do-it-yourself kind of nature of this industry. Like, there's the permissionlessness of this industry tells a lot, you know, just get started. Like, people often ask, like, Mauricio, where do I start? Like, anywhere. Everywhere now. but just start now. So I think that comes across when you're talking, but also the power of community. Like you mentioned Dennis, you mentioned other people that have helped or inspired you to do what you're doing. And here you are now, not only doing the same, but also inspiring, you know, the next generation, educating the next generation, and making sure that, you know, the passion comes across as you do it, which is obviously, you know, some form of like just giving back to the community as well. I always talk about paying it forward. And I think, you know, educators in the industry, more in Web3 than any other industry, are definitely paying forward, because the amount of user generated content that we have in this industry is incredible because of this permissionlessness that we have baked into to what we do, from the very infrastructure to how we carry ourselves as community members. So yeah, kudos to you on that, man, because this definitely comes across. Now, let me switch gears a little bit and let's talk Vietnam, right? So we talked Web3 and video and content, which is great, but I know from personal experience that moving countries is a massive undertaking. It is, sometimes it's by chance, sometimes it's planned, but obviously plans are made to be broken because that's, you know, such is life. How was your process? You know, how did you decide? Was it, you know, was it heavy on you? How the circumstances shaped that decision, and how did you kind of manage to pull through?
Yes, I mean, this is my second stint in Vietnam. I lived in Saigon from 2012 to 2015. That one was a lot more random. So that one, I worked for a tech company for about 4 years when I finished university, between 2008 to 2012, in just outside London. And I always had in my mind that I wanted to move abroad somewhere. I had been to Southeast Asia, but not Vietnam. But a good friend of mine got back from Vietnam around about the time that I was thinking of going there. He sold me on Vietnam, put me in touch with some friends he made. And I sort of made the plan to come out for 6 months and ended up staying 3.5 years because it's a fantastic place. And I moved back to London with another job. And I always had in the back of my mind I'd come back at some point. Still had some very good friends out here. So the second move was a little bit more, I suppose, less random. So a good friend of mine, Vietnamese guy called Min, had set up the business Sense while the time I was back in London. But we worked together at a previous company in Saigon. And after COVID, the country was opening up again. And he said, hey, do you want to come out? I need some help. Do you want to manage the sales and marketing teams? And it was around about the time that I was, my other company that I was working for was going through an acquisition. And, you know, I then girlfriend, now fiance, she was also very keen on the idea of moving abroad. I think I'd subconsciously sold Vietnam to by telling her so many great stories. So it sort of, things just fell into place, and it all sort of happened quite easily. And I'm very lucky. My fiance is literally the most happy-go-lucky person in the world, and she's just very much lives moment by moment, which is great, more so than I do. So it was, yeah, a quick conversation. We were both like, yeah, we looked into the possibility of it. Jobs lined up. She got a job through a friend of mine in a different sector. And we moved out to Saigon in June 22. And very happy with our decision. We're now a little bit further up the country by the beach in Da Nang. But it's a nice life out here.
What's that meme? I live where you vacation.
Very much. I do feel bad sometimes, because honestly, my life does feel like a holiday. But I'm I don't take it for granted. It's a great place to be. And what I was very happy to discover this time around is there's an incredible Web3 community here as well. Absolutely buzzing. And it's a fantastic place to be in anything innovative tech.
Let's double click on that. I know, and there's video evidence of it, that you are, as much as I am, a sucker for use cases, right? What you look into is,
how this technology or technologies, because you've been dabbling into AI as well, but how technologies actually help solve real problems like people's and businesses. How do you build solutions on technology? Not just for technology's sake, and I haven't seen you shill any, oh, this token ABC is gonna pump. Like, you're as much of a sucker for use cases as I am. And I've seen a few of the videos and you're talking about a few, but what are very specific use cases from Vietnam? Because the power of being global, decentralized, you know, natively digital, borderless, etc., it permissionless, it applies to anybody and anyone who wants to play in this industry, but the solutions tend to be very local and they tend to resolve very localized problems in very particular ways. What is your experience and what are the use cases you've seen locally that you thought like, wow, this is very particular to this region, or this is a very interesting way that this place is solving for that problem? Can you elaborate on some of that? Because I'm very curious about this kind of regional flavor of things, because not only the regulations tend to differ, but also there's cultural aspects of how people, you know, carry on their daily lives that play a part into solving for a specific problem sets.
Yeah, cool. So great question. So I think with Vietnam, there's a couple of things. There's the first one, which is kind of DeFi and crypto, the value proposition itself. And secondly, there's the demographics within the country, culturally, the entrepreneurship. And I'll touch on that in a sec. But I think the first thing that hit me was arrived here, buzzing Web3 community, lots of people very familiar and comfortable using cryptocurrency, DeFi. And I found out, I read a report quite quickly after arriving. It was a chain analysis report for 2021 and 2022. Vietnam was number one in the world for crypto adoption. So at the beginning, it was like, wow, okay, I'm starting to see that. But the longer I was here, it sort of started to click as why that was. So, I mean, initially you've got a country of 100 million, so it's a big population. Two thirds of the country are under 30, so very, very young population, tech savvy. The government for a while has been very software and development focused in terms of the educational drive. So there's a conveyor belt of fantastic talent. I suppose, as with any emerging market, I think very similar, and you look at sort of Africa and South America as well, is what you have is a combination of things. You've got, historically inflationary currencies, a fairly deep set distrust in some traditional finance. And what comes with that is high levels of unbanked population, lack of access to credit. I think it's about a third of the third of Vietnamese population, which is 100 million, is unbanked. And I think about 50% don't have access to credit. So what we're doing here is kind of making a list of the value propositions of cryptocurrency and DeFi, fundamentally what its, you know, real use case is, not speculative trading, but what it could actually address. And I think these combined with some cultural aspects of Vietnamese and, they're very investment savvy as well. It just kind of match made in heaven. So I think that's one big use case in terms of DeFi, cryptocurrency. When I mentioned these sort of unbanked and that lack of access to credit, another thing is they're one of the highest in the world in terms of mobile phone penetration. So again, all you need is to set up a wallet, all you need to access some of these tools, theoretically, internet connection, phone. The second thing is there is an unrivaled entrepreneurial spirit to the Vietnamese. This is something I've witnessed, and it's just, not just for Web3, for anything. I remember when I first arrived in Vietnam 10 years ago, and, I'd have a 22-year-old sort of fresh graduate working as on the admin team, very shy, quiet, and you speak to her and she's got three or four little side hustles, you wouldn't expect at all. She's running a family's coffee business on the side, and she's got a little you know, architectural design businesses, right? It's crazy, and it's just so normalized to start businesses. You know, the government as well, they put a lot of emphasis on encouraging this, and it's a good environment for startups. But you know, you speak to most young Vietnamese, and they are running businesses. So that combined with the developer talent and this conveyor belt of really, really good young talent, it fits well with Web3. You know, so when I you know, I'm going to be back in Saigon tomorrow and Friday, I'm going to meet up with a couple of friends, and you know, there's one young Vietnamese guy who's got about 5 projects on the go that he's running, you know, and you speak to him and his just passion for the space is infectious. You know, but he's also running his sort of family's shop, you know, and living with his parents still, which they do till quite later in life. And it's just, when you think entrepreneur, or me anyway, when I think London entrepreneur, you have this image of someone. Vietnam, everyone's an entrepreneur. And just that it, again, you know, the Web3, the community aspect of it, you know, the fact that anyone can go and start a business, and we've seen all sorts of people, you know, they've gone straight into Web3 without any Web2 kind of understanding of business, which is fantastic. You know, the barriers to entry are, you know, wonderfully low, I think. And I think that favors, you know, emerging markets and stuff like this. And again, where you're seeing great projects coming out of places like Africa and South America as well, you know, which I think is really, really nice. Really, really nice to see.
I like that you tapped into that, because there is this common belief, especially if you are from a global South country like I am, and you've been in this industry for as long as I've been, there is a this kind of belief that crypto adoption is happening in the global South, but we don't talk about it. Like, it's almost like, you know, a taboo to acknowledge that countries with a totalitarian history, or a history of, you know, fragile conditions, both economic and social, they did not have access to bleeding edge technology up until crypto. Because crypto is, again, permissionless, and anyone can join. And if you have a mobile phone with internet access, you can access crypto, and you can have economical and social and community impact as you do it. We don't talk about it, and maybe we don't talk about it enough. Maybe, but I've had multiple guests in the show from emerging markets that are doing amazing things. They are collaborating across regions, because that's the nature of this thing, and we're seeing actual adoption. The fact that in developed countries the headlines are, well, the institutionals are coming. There's BlackRock's of the world and Franklin Templeton's of the world and funds and ETFs. The real breakthrough has nothing to do with financial speculation. It has to do almost with financial inclusion and dignity, which have been enabled by crypto in very basic use cases. I saw a lecture here in London when I arrived about 2 years ago, when the person said, there is no killer use case for crypto yet. This is 2 years ago. And I'm thinking, what the hell are stablecoins then? Like, this is completely like Euro first world centric analysis. And we're missing a lot of the innovation that's coming from countries like Vietnam, Brazil. A number of African countries are actually disrupting cross-border payments within the continent. And obviously that nobody else cares is because nobody else has the problem that they do, and they're not solving the problems as they are. And it's remarkable. And I appreciate you raising that point, because I don't think, even I don't speak a lot about those use cases in the show, because they don't make the headlines because they don't yield clicks. And it's interesting that this is something that you, being a Londoner and living in Vietnam, has, you know, have like firsthand access to that. Now, one thing that is always the counterpoint to, you know, the good thing is, what are the challenges? What were the challenges that you faced when moving, and what do you think are the challenges that these entrepreneurs that have a lower barrier to entry? I mean, it's not all, you know, fun and games. I bet that there are challenges there that they're having to overcome. Can you elaborate more what these are?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think there's going to be challenges that are, you know, global. You know, there's lots of macro factors that are affecting industries worldwide, and these will obviously have a pit, you know, an impact on any new technology and things like funding and whatnot. So I don't think there's anything particularly new there. I think within the Web3 space as a whole, obviously you've got regulation. You know, technology evolves and then regulation has a lag behind it. And when you're looking at things that involve things like, you know, cross-border payments and whatnot, you know, it's an absolute minefield, you know. So for, in my mind, the technology in so many areas is so far ahead of where regulation is, which not only impacts how a project can evolve, but also potential investment, you know, perception. And then, as we all know, particularly in the world of Web3, a lot of the, you know, ethos of Web3 is transparency and traceability and stuff. And there are big powers that be in many sectors that actually would oppose that, right? So I think that Web3 faces some quite unique challenges. But, you know, in terms of Vietnam specifically, I would suppose there is a, in terms of local government, there is a lot of gray areas around regulation within Vietnam, sort of purposefully gray. They support some areas, they support blockchain and, you know, blockchain development. They're less keen on, you know, speculative crypto trading. I think a big push for the government is to, you know, they're very hot at the minute. Their focus is, you know, anti-money laundering and protecting the Vietnamese currency after, you know, 10, 15 years ago, some very, very high inflation. So they are wary over cryptocurrency. But in terms of companies utilizing and exploring blockchain technology, they are very, very supportive of. So I think a slight challenge is this very obvious sort of gray area. And I think, obviously, again, that will impact things like investors coming in with their money and whatnot, which obviously has a knock-on effect because a lot of these entrepreneurs, you know, don't have huge amounts of capital behind them. But, you know, again, then the flip side of that is you have Vietnam as a country that living costs are low. As a lot of these entrepreneurs, you know, are running businesses from, you know, their family homes where they're not having an outgoing of rent, and, you know, costs of staff is lower here. So I suppose your money goes further than if you're starting up a business in London. So I think there's two sides to the coin. But I think, yeah, regulation would probably be one of the biggest challenges, but that's not unique to Vietnam.
No, definitely. I think regulators are getting smarter. I recently spoke to a friend who's not even 30 years old, and he is now an analyst in a regulatory agency. And I'm like, that's what we need: crypto native folks joining the ranks on a regulatory agency. So the thinking starts from, yeah, we know this. And not like, oh my God, what this is, I'm afraid, I don't understand, I want to shut it down. So I think it will be a generational shift when more crypto native people start to find their ways into regulatory agencies. Not because they can't do the thing in the industry, because I bet they can, but more to the fact that they're like, okay, maybe if I try to help evolve the industry from the inside, everybody gets a shot at this. So very, very interesting to see this movement, this recent movement. So I'm with you.
I see. Yeah. And like, so quite a few of the businesses that I've worked with before are, in sort of neighboring countries. So Singapore, Hong Kong, other Asian countries, a bit further away, so Japan and South Korea. I know particularly Japan, I think Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore have always had fairly crypto-friendly regulations. And I think a lot of the reason behind that is they've been very open to working with, like your friend, people who come from the Web3 space. And particularly in Hong Kong, I think, you know, they work very closely with Web3 businesses. So the regulations are kind of a bit of a team effort from businesses within the space and sort of governments who are looking to learn because they see the potential of it, but they both see the benefit of working together. And I think that is going to be key for which countries really push forward, is having that kind of coexistence between people building in the space and people regulating the space. I think it's no surprise that there's a lot of projects coming out of Hong Kong, Singapore, Japan, Taiwan as well, just because of that approach that a lot of these Asian countries seem to be taking.
Let me explore that. So if I'm a regulator, okay, a little bit of role play here. If I'm a regulator and I came across a Shandalani video on LinkedIn and it grabbed my attention. I'm now trying to double down and learn more. What is the onboarding kit you would suggest for me as a incoming regulator in the space to kind of start to get to where I need to be to, you know, stop being afraid and start seeing the benefits of blockchains and cryptocurrencies and Web3 in general?
So I think it's probably a combination of self-learning and talking to the right people. And those of course cross over, but you know, for very, very day one trying to understand the space, you know, the most important thing I did at the beginning was, well, very initially I started kind of looking into the tech, which is easy to come across. All the information was tech led, but I'm not technical at heart, right? That's not my background. I've worked in tech. It's always been from a commercial standpoint. So I kind of hit brick walls quite early with that. You know, I could only go so far. So the kind of way that kind of really made things click for me was initially just picking a sector that I was interested in and researching the technology with that. So with the blockchain within, you know, gaming, blockchain within healthcare, or maybe even taking some specific application, looking at NFTs within travel, NFTs within the sports sector. That is sometimes what it just needs to make something click, gain a bit of interest. And then sort of within your research there, finding businesses that are operating within that space, that are building within that space. Just like an investor would go and do a bit of due diligence, find out who these people are, who's running the businesses, who are the founders, what's their track history, and go and connect with them, speak with them. You know, certainly from a regulator's point of view, if a regulator is doing this, you know, a well-run, good, honest business within the Web3 space would gladly have that conversation. Because as I said, if you can work together with your jurisdiction's regulators, that's the best thing you can be doing, because you can effectively influence the regulations that will be coming in the next 12 to 18 months. Yeah, I think it all comes down to the kind of forward thinking nature of both the people within the startup and also the regulators. Yeah, I'd say that's the kind of first point.
To wrap it up, because we're approaching the end of our hour, what is the one thing that we need to address now to avoid working for the next 20 years in the industry, then looking in hindsight and saying, ha, we forgot this and we did all this work and we ended up in the same place? What is this one thing and why?
So great question. I'd say that there are quite a few things. And I
nope, you don't get to pick more than one.
I will pick one, but I don't like saying it so succinctly because it sounds like there should be an easy fix where there's not. And I'm very much a believer on the way, but onboarding UX, onboarding user experience for kind of Web3 technology is still, although we've made huge headway, you know, for a complete layman who has no idea what Web3 is, it's still a difficult process. And it's still, it comes with its risks, right? And it's not, it's not habitual to Web3 habits and common practices. I will say that, you know, everyone talks a lot about mass adoption and this, that, and the other, right? But you know, the true test of mass adoption will be when everybody is using Web3 tech, but they've got no idea they're doing just that, which is exactly how technology should be. It should be something that just happens in the background, right? And we'll get there. Like, there'll be a point when, you know, your passport, your academic credentials will be NFTs, but you'll probably have no idea that it is an NFT. And that's exactly the way it should be. Probably won't be called an NFT. Perception has been damaged quite a lot. So, but that's fine. That's the way it should be. Yeah, as I say, we've made great headway, but that's the biggest thing in my mind.
I'm thankful that you said this, because, you know, now the audience knows that it's not just me talking about UX all the time. So there you have it, folks. It is important, and we're not doing enough in that front. Now, Sean, as we wrap up, what is the best way for people to keep track of you, learn from you, engage with you online and elsewhere? What's the path to Sean Delaney?
Cool. So find me on LinkedIn. So yeah, Sean Delaney on LinkedIn. That is where you will see most of my content that's geared around those videos that we were talking about and a lot of my Web3 and branding stuff. And if you're not interested in that, but you are interested in Vietnamese views and food, then you can find my Instagram for the rest of it.
Awesome. Sean, man, thank you so much for taking the time. I know you're headed out in a long trip, so safe travels, my man. And yeah, hope to catch up soon. Thanks so much.
Thanks, buddy. Yeah, looking forward to our next breakfast, mate.
That'll be great. Cheers. Catch us online. We're on Instagram at BlockDrops Podcast, on Twitter at BlockDrops Pod or Xerox Mauricio. We're on Lens at blockdrops.lens. We have a newsletter on LinkedIn. Write to us at blockdropspodcast@gmail.com. And you can listen to the BlockDrops Podcast at Spotify, iColab, Fabriboon Tech, and all of the other major streaming platforms. Shout out to Sean for sharing so much with us about content creation and his journey in Web3. Don't forget to leave the ratings on your favorite player. This is all for today. Stay rare, stay weird. LFG.